So there are lots of field theories that support one-dimensional objects. These are these are the classic ones, magnetic flux tubes in a superconductor, where you're seeing an array of them end on. And in fact, if you have any field theory that supports such solutions, if it undergoes a phase transition in the early universe from a phase that doesn't have strings to one that does have strings, then you'll produce a network, and the network will just on its own grow with the expansion of the universe, so that today you would have strings the size of galaxies, and even strings that span the entire visible universe. So this is certainly something to think about. And in fact, in string theory, you have enormous numbers of potential one-dimensional objects. You have the fundamental strings themselves. You have my favorites, the dual D-strings. Various higher dimensional objects that are wrapped, so you see only one dimension. And then also in the low energy effective theory, you still have an effective field theory, which may support solitons, which are magnetic flux tubes, or electric flux tubes. And in fact, for any of these kinds of microscopic strings, there is some corresponding phase transition that could produce them. And so there's a wealth of potential cosmic strings in string theory. And as you look at that list, well, there's two things that come to mind. First, what is the prospect for detecting any of these? But second, if you see something, you know, to what extent can you distinguish the different kinds of cosmic string, the microscopic theory? And this is the cosmic string intercept problem. I take this name from LHC physics, where various groups have adopted the name the inverse problem, for the problem of going back from the LHC observations to the underlying theory. And I'd been working on this for a while at that point. So, well, that's what I'm doing too. So this is the cosmic string inverse problem. If we see cosmic strings, how do we figure out their microscopic properties? And really, there's an intervening layer between these, because you don't directly see the underlying, the microscopic structure. You see, you measure a bunch of macroscopic parameters, and from those you try to discern the model. So, in the language of the LHC, this step would be model building, and this step would be phenomenology. And in fact, my talk is all about phenomenology. So, now, although at a microscopic level there were very different and exotic kinds of string involved, but in a cosmic situation, these are all extremely long compared to their thickness, and so they're not so different. The most obvious thing that distinguishes any of them is their string tension nu. But also, in fact, as you scan over models, there are other macroscopic properties that differ. The most obvious is that when two strings collide, their microscopic structure, their internal structure, certainly matters. The two most obvious things that can happen are that they pass through each other, or that they switch ends and reconnect. So they reconnect with probability p, or pass through with probability 1 minus p. And if you only had two models to deal with, the gauge theory solitons and the fundamental strings, this would be enough to distinguish them, because the gauge theory solitons always reconnect. They're basically big and fat and can't really get through each other. And the fundamental strings usually pass through each other. The reconnection is a quantum process of order g squared. So if you just had two models, then this would be enough. But of course, model builders are tremendously creative, and there will always be more models than there are signatures. And so additional things. One is on the string, are its only degrees of freedom its wiggles, or are there additional degrees of freedom, fermions or bosons moving up and down it? What are the long-range interactions of the string? Are they only gravitational, the minimal possibility, or are there additional scalar interactions, axionic interactions, or gauge interactions? Is there one kind of string or many? And if you have many kinds of string, then you have the possibility of these multi-string junctions where strings meet. Now, I'm going to actually focus this. So this, I've actually promised more than I can deliver with my title, because I'm really going to focus on the simplest kind of strings, which I call vanilla strings, which have Basically, none of this extra stuff. No, there are only long-range interactions of gravitational, no extra degrees of freedom, only one kind. And so these are the only two parameters, and actually, initially, this is the only parameter. These are what come up in the simplest models. And they, as I'll explain, already these simplest strings present a major challenge. This is again, primarily a technical talk focused on, after I get through the background and introduction, a specific problem. And the specific problem shows up with these simplest vanilla strings. I should mention that, for instance, superconducting strings, which have gauge interactions, their signatures are entirely different. They interact strongly with magnetic fields and with plasmas. And so it's an entirely different story and an interesting one. But so of all of these, this is the one which is sort of most orthogonal to what I'm talking about. But equally interesting, but just very different. OK, so as I said, the simplest vanilla strings. And the reason that I'm talking about this is because it presents, it turns out, an interesting, fascinating theoretical problem. So this is a simulation of, this is an old simulation. So this idea, again, in the context of field theory, this idea has been around for almost 30 years. So, and this is a simulation of what a network of cosmic strings would look like. So this is our universe with all the boring stuff like galaxies omitted. And the scale of the picture is roughly, again, our visible universe. And you see a bunch of strings sort of crossing the entire visible universe, and then smaller, hard to resolve in this picture, but a bunch of loops, which are small on the scale of the picture, but still of galactic size. And one would like to have a quantitative understanding of this network. How much string is there? How big are these loops? In order to talk about signatures in a quantitative way, and especially in order to distinguish strings which differ in subtle ways. And there were initially arguments that the horizon distance, the Hubble time, is the only relevant scale in the problem. And I'll mention later on why that was thought. But if that were true, then this would be an easy problem, because if it was a one-scale problem, then you would just simulate the network. So, you know, you start with some fairly generic initial condition. After a phase transition, the universe expands. You follow the strings. And simulations would have just said, this is what the network looks like. But they didn't, because in fact, there isn't just one scale in the problem. If you look at this, you see, looking at a long string, that there's a kinked structure that persists. It's not smooth. There's a kinked structure that persists down to very short scales. And also, the loops are really tiny. They're not similar to the size of the box. And so the simulations, it was quickly realized, were saying that they weren't working in the sense that it's not a one-scale problem. It's a multiple-scale problem, and that makes it hard. You know, in fact, no existing simulation has a dynamical range of volumes and times large enough to, you know, to say what's happening in a convincing way. And analytic methods have been extremely limited and crude because it's a highly nonlinear problem. So you know, when I started to learn about, so I got interested in the question, you know, we find strings, how do we figure out that they're, you know, gravity strings? And the more I learned, the more I realized, you know, this was not well understood. But I looked at this and I said, look, these are strings. I'm a string theorist. How hard can this be? And that was 3 years ago and many false starts. Because my initial thought was there's some kind of ensemble here. It's like a thermal ensemble. And some path integral would produce this. But in fact, it's a very dynamical thing. It's more like turbulence. One reason it's more like turbulence, in fact, so I should say, before one, so if you just take the simulations and the groups that have tried to interpret them and their estimates of the sizes of the loops, you'll find published estimates that range over more than 50 orders of magnitude. So this is a completely deterministic problem. The initial conditions are well specified, the equations of motion are fully specified, and yet the qualitative form of the solution is uncertain to 50 orders of magnitude. And even if you eliminate one outlier group that may actually be right, there are still many groups spanned over 20 orders of magnitude. So this is a problem that one has to think about. And so after, again, a variety of false starts, so this is largely work with my student George Rocha and in part with a postdoc, Florian DeBath. After many false starts, we hit on the idea, look, since the problem is a large ratio of scales, well, again, in field quantum field theory, we have ways to deal with this. This is what the renormalization group is for. Now, it turns out that this is not exactly a problem to which you can apply sort of any kind of standard normalization group technology. For one reason, with a renormalization group, basically, you start at small scales and evolve towards long. Here, the basic flow is in the other direction, and I'll tell you why. So, again, the scale of the box is the horizon scale. It's how far we can see it grows linearly in time. The spring network itself, if it were just co-moving with the expansion of the universe, would grow with the scale factor, which is the 1/2 or the 2/3 power of the time slower. And so if you scale the picture so the box size stays fixed, the strings are actually getting closer together. The structure is flowing from long distances down to short. And so this is a problem which is more like turbulence, where the random initial conditions are sort of imposed at long distance, and the dynamical flow is towards short. So it's opposite to the normalization group. Nevertheless, we've been able to use this sort of RG philosophy to, we think, make a lot of progress, not in as sharp and precise a way as the renormalization group, but in a way that, well, we are able, I think, to sort of understand many of the features seen in simulations. So again, I'm not going to focus just on this one problem. I want to, first of all, review what that network of strings does after, well, what its life cycle is. Signatures of these vanilla strings, these gravitational-only strings, and then our model of the short-distance structure and where things currently stand. Okay, so there are six processes. It's not so complicated, but there are six basic processes that take place in the evolution of the universe, kind of the life cycle of string. And I'll take you through them one at a time. First, the network forms. And as I said, so for the field theory strings, the simplest situation in which you get strings is if there's a broken U1 symmetry, and in that case you have these topological defects where the phase winds as you go around them. So again, if you have a phase transition in which a symmetry goes from being unbroken to broken, the field starts at the origin. After the transition, it has to roll. And these transitions happen all the time in the early universe due to thermal effects or scalar fields rolling. So the field has to choose a direction. It has to roll to one of the minima. And by causality, it doesn't choose the same direction everywhere in space-time. And so over long scales, it chooses many different directions. And you find, just randomly, there'll be regions of trapped winding. And that's indeed what this simulation, this is. So this is a simulation of the initial condition. Where, sorry, I don't have the authors, but where the field has been assigned sort of random directions, and then they looked after a while where the trapped winding was, the strings. And so just by causality, you must form strings. It's a statement that strings don't communicate over long distances. Roughly half the string is in the forms of loops, which quickly decay. They're not so interesting. And roughly half is in the form of infinite random walks. And those are the things that seed, actually, the later network. So this is for the one kind of string, the string which is a classical soliton in the low energy gauge theory. And the fantastic insight of Henry Tai and his various students is that for other strings, for any kind of string, there is some dual version of this story. So they were focused on inflation from d d bar, d brain, anti d brain annihilation, And these strings, the Earth-like strings, left over, and it sounds very higher dimensional and exotic, but in fact, in terms of its effective four-dimensional description, it's the same thing. And similarly, there's some dual story for any of those different microscopic strings. So the first thing, you need a phase transition of the right type. And now for gravitational strings, as I'll get to, the higher the tension, the better, because they couple more strongly to gravity, they're easier to see. You would like this transition to be as then early as possible, high in energy scale as possible. And happily, the kind of inflation that cosmologists most seem to like, hybrid, well, one of them, hybrid inflation, terminates with just such a phase transition. Also, the simplest string model of inflation, dB bar inflation, terminates with such a transition. So this is one of the uncertainties, but it's, in a large and interesting class of models, these strings will form. Now, this is an item that wasn't on my outline because it's something that doesn't want to happen. So strings aren't necessarily stable. Depending on the microphysics, they can either, so this was a this wanted to be a closed string, but under some circumstances, string can break by a pair production of endpoints, and a closed string will just turn into dust, and that would be uninteresting. Or in a different class of models, opposite strands of the string are attracted to each other, and so past a certain point in time, the string contracts instead of growing. And there, these most kinds of strings potentially suffer from one or the other of these instabilities, but as Ed Copeland, Rob, and I showed, it can easily be the case that the parameters are such that this is slow, either of these is slow on cosmological timescales, and so the strings do survive. And so the two question marks are, did the right kind of transition happen at the right time, and does one have enough of a kind of separation of scales to allow the strings to be stable? So that's why this is not a guaranteed signature, but it's a signature in a large class of models. And really, I think, in terms of all the kinds of exotic new cosmological physics one thinks about, this is the sort of the best bet. Anyway, if the strings form and don't decay, they just stretch with the expansion of the universe. So these are the equations that you get from the NAMBU action in expanding spacetime. The string wiggles, but has a Hubble damping term. So on long scales, it's frozen. On short scales, it wiggles and redshifts. There's a nice representation to this equation if you form sort of right-moving and left-moving tangent vectors. So for a string in flat spacetime, you separate it into right-moving and left-moving modes. In curved spacetime, there's a similarly useful separation into the right-moving and left-moving tangent vectors. But when the universe is expanding, A dot over A is non-zero, they don't just propagate freely to the right and left. They talk to each other. And so this is a useful representation. Again, these are unit vectors, and I will make use of this at several points later on. Okay, so they expand. Long strings, so what began as random walks, they start to straighten as they come inside the horizon. And they'll run into each other. And when they run into each other, when they reconnect, and for the most simple vanilla strings, I'll assume they always reconnect, they initially form a sharp kink, which separates into a right and left moving kink on each string. So each collision leads to four kinks. And in the simulations, you see those kinks, and the closer you look, the more kinks you see. It's that one question is it fractal, or how do we describe its geometry? But it forms this kink structure that you see in the simulations. That's three, four. On very short scales, the strings do straighten because they emit gravitational radiation. The gravitational radiation, okay, because there are derivatives in the action, because it couples to energy, it's stronger at higher frequency. And so as you get to shorter distances on the string, it becomes important. Now, this is the first appearance in my talk of a dimensionless parameter that is vital. which is the string tension times Newton's constant. It measures how strongly the string couples to the metric. It also measures how close to the Planck scale the string tension is. And current bounds and interesting models make this a number around 10 to the minus 7th or a little less. So that's the kind of number to keep in mind. So it's a small number. And so at small scales on the string, at sufficiently small scales, where you begin to see this small parameter, the string smooths. There's an interesting story here I won't go through, but early estimates just sort of did dimensional analysis. And well, more than that, they thought it went linearly in that parameter. But there's a subtlety when long wavelength and short wavelength modes meet on the string. And in fact the smoothing takes place on a shorter scale. The small parameter is raised to a higher power, where this is an exponent that I'll explain in a little while, well, eventually. Fifth, when a single long string intersects itself, it forms a loop. And again, because of the kink structure, these things are wiggling all over. This is likely to happen. And the loops then decay by gravitational radiation. And in fact, it's actually it's interesting to this. Well, so again, the same dimensionless parameter appears governing their lifetime. And it's interesting to distinguish strings that are small and live less than a Hubble time from strings that are large and live many Hubble times. And the dividing line is, again, it's the Hubble size scale. It's the size of the visible universe times this small dimensionless parameter. Again, gamma is around 50. That is the dividing line between large loops and small loops. OK, so here is the life cycle of string again. And it's not so hard to simulate. Basically, you just have expansion and intercommutation. The smoothing by gravitational radiation can be put in by hand. And the loop decay by gravitational radiation can be put in by hand. So with that simulation that I showed you, basically simulated the stretching and the intercommutation and put in the gravitational radiation by hand. OK. Now, so in organizing the way to think about these, there's a scaling hypothesis due to Kibble, which is a critical idea in this subject. Namely, again, if only expansion were operating, if the strings just expanded with the size of with the universe itself, then all of the distances in the network would grow as a scale factor. However, the actual claim of Kibble is that it grows, these distances grow more rapidly. They grow as the Hubble length, which is to say that these various processes that I've described have the effect of removing string from the network. So there's less string, the distances are greater, and this is the greatest distance that causality would allow. Things can't have talked to each other over longer distances. So the Kibble's claim is that the most efficient string removal mechanisms would give you length scales that grow as the horizon length. And his claim was that in fact, this is the case. And if you can make simple models, actually, there is strong evidence this is true of the simulations, but you can make simple models. There's basically a feedback where if you get more string, you get more collisions, they make more kinks. The more kinks make more loops. And when you have more loops, then they decay and you have less string. And you can turn that into a differential equation called the one-scale model, or a fancier differential equation called the two-scale model, so on. Anyway, but there's a feedback, and in fact, it does have the effect of making the network scale so that the statistical properties of the network are constant on the Hubble scale. Okay. So I'm just saying how they scale. They both are linear in T. So I'm not. Very good point. Very good point. So thank you. So almost all of the simulations have been done during the radiation and matter eras when these things are proportional, and that's for the most part relevant because most of the signature that we're seeing are from strings that decayed before acceleration began. In fact, you know, there have not been careful studies
of the effective acceleration on the network, which is important for recent signatures like close-in lensing. But it's a sufficiently small perturbation on the story because it only affects very recent and very close streams. It does have deadlock data, it does. Okay, and so again, simulating and then trying to read the tea leaves as to what your simulation is saying at the last few, you know, frames still leave this very wide range of potential scales for the size of the loops, namely rather of order the Hubble length, but rather smaller, which is kind of what it looked like maybe in those pictures. There's been a recent and very interesting claim that in fact the typical loops are much larger, almost the size of the Hubble length. Now this seems to disagree with the evidence of your eyes, because you remember in the simulations the loop looked very small. But what these folks have done is they run for longer. And they claim that those small loops that you saw are transients, and the real population of loops is in much larger loops. And then there are conjectures, claims that in fact, the gravitational radiation smoothing of the long strings plays an essential role in the network evolution, which gives you scales that are smaller by this parameter or powers of it. And then there's a claim, which again seems probably not right, but it's not as crazy as it sounds, that in fact the loops are set by the size of the loops is set by the true UV cutoff in nature, the string thickness. So these scales, these estimates run over 20 orders of magnitude, and this is the outlier, which is 30 orders of magnitude smaller scale still. But even if without the you'll see later why this is not so crazy, but even without the outlier, they span a wide range of scales. So now let's talk about how these affect the signatures. And again, I'm talking about vanilla strings whose signatures are gravitational. And so these are the likely signatures, gravitational signatures. Again, this dimensionful parameter plays a key role. It's how strongly the string couples to the metric, and so all of these signatures depend in an essential way on this number. And in terms of, so in models of hybrid inflation, the model where inflation terminates with one of these phase transitions, you can tie the scale of the string tension to the scale of inflation. And then depending on the details of the model, you can tie the scale of inflation to the observed microwave anisotropies. And so in these models of inflation based on brain anti-brain annihilation, Jones, Stoic, and Tai hit on what seemed like an interesting range as they scanned over a variety of models constrained in this way. And this is probably an interesting range more generally for if inflation takes place at a high scale and is of the hybrid type. So let's focus on this range of numbers. So first of all, these strings are not dark matter. It is true. Well, so in the scaling regime, the strings the energy density does scale the same way as the dominant matter, whatever it is, matter or radiation, but it involves this small parameter, and so the string energy density is always a small fraction of the total. It's not the dark matter. Again, in some of these non-vanilla networks, you can try to there are scenarios in which strings would be the dark matter, but not the simple ones. Perturbations to CMB is one of the classic ways. So and these come primarily from long strings. So the network has long strings and loops. And some of the signatures come primarily from long strings, some primarily from loops. These come primarily from the long strings, and so they're a bit less, they're much more well understood, although, well, not certain, but much more well understood. And the scaling property that I mentioned implies that they give perturbations that are scale invariant, which is why 20 years ago they were a serious candidate for the origin of the galaxies. But eventually it became clear that they aren't the origin, because the power spectrum, this is a cartoon of the power spectrum. Actually,
I should probably do a better job because people have been looking at this more. But the main lesson to take from this is that whereas the observations, of course, have acoustic peaks, which are nicely fit by the lambda CDM model, the problem with strings is they produce their perturbations rather late. You don't have this story of the perturbation coming inside the horizon and starting to ring. The strings produce their perturbations rather late, and so they don't produce this ringing, and so they don't produce the peaks. So this model is ruled out. Instead, this becomes a limit. In fact, if you try to fit lambda CDM plus strings, then in fact the fit allows as much as 10% or 5% of the power to come from strings, which gives now an upper limit, which is in this ballpark. So yes, please.
Go back two slides for just a second.
Yeah.
One more forward there. Okay, so you said that there haven't really been any simulations yet that follow what's going on with strings during the accelerating phase.
That's right.
This isn't really matter domination anymore. It's dark.
That's right.
Do you have any intuition or guesses about how that might change?
Well, since I'm talking about gravitational radiation signatures, it probably would not be so hard to work out the current sort of make an estimate of the current string density, which would be relevant for things like lensing at very close distances. But for almost all of the signatures, that I'm talking about, the strings were early. And so it does affect things, but only in a simple way that I'll get. So, yeah. Okay. So
the balance in the power spectrum is in the ballpark of G mu less than 2 × 10⁻⁷, which is at the upper end of that range of interesting models. So to the extent that it improves, it starts to look at interesting models. Now, the power spectrum, again, is a pretty coarse thing. You might think it would be more effective to look for string-like structures, spatial structures. And that turned out, well, that's improving, but that turned out not so far to be so effective. Its bounds are weaker. Stronger, actually, is moving strings. Strings moving sideways to you will produce a blue shift on one side and a red shift on the other, which distorts the black body. You no longer have a black body spectrum. And the spectrum is known to be a black body well enough that this actually gives not a bad bound on string tension, but still in the same ballpark. And polarization should eventually improve this by a couple of magnitude. But every time I give this talk, I have to add more slides because there are clever people looking at these things in new ways, and especially now that one is seeing higher and higher multiples of the CMB, these folks, you can ask Mark about this, have just a couple days ago, observed that strings have a relatively larger effect at higher multiples. So even if they're only 10% down here, they're of order one effect up here, and the blue curve is lambda CDM. And the dashed curve is lambda CDM plus strings near the current upper limit. So, you don't get excited about 3-1 sigma points. But especially, Mark, you can say there are many other uncertainties in those points, right?
Yeah, but this is more of a demonstration of future sensitivity.
Right. But is Doppler effect included in this case? The Doppler effect be the last slide?
It cuts in at higher
up. Yeah. Even higher.
It's more dominant at higher up, yes.
Another recent and future observation is, again, the small scale surveys will be able to see stringy structures. And what this group says is that ACT, which I'm not sure what the time scale on that is, you should be able to see stringy structures by eye,
at the current upper limit. They don't give numbers on how much this can be improved, but they say it should be improved with you know, a more sophisticated approach to the statistics. So again, some prospect for further improvement. Lensing, okay, so strings lens, and you know, they produce, if they're straight, these distinctive simple double images, unlike point sources which produce these arcs. And actually,
and so again, the same number, the current upper limit, is an angle of one arc second, so it's an interesting one. And in fact, I think this recently, again, the first survey that was sufficiently systematic to produce limits produces a limit from lensing, which is again the same ballpark as everything else, 3 × 10⁻⁷. So it's claimed that in the over a time scale of 10 years or with a lot of Hubble time, one could improve this by a couple of the magnitude either in the radio or in the optical. Now I should say there is, I haven't been talking about my theoretical problem, the nature of the networks. And by the way, lensing, of course, so CMB is from long strings because they act more coherently. Lensing, long strings will lens, loops will lens if they're big enough and there are enough of them. But at least it's a robust signature because long strings will lens. There is a network question, though, even for the long strings, which is these searches assume that the string is straight enough to produce nice symmetric double images. You saw the simulation, the string is actually rather kinked at short distances. Should we actually be thinking about the string as being straight or highly kinked, which would then produce complex multiple images? Also, a straight string, you'll have multiple lensed objects more or less in a line. A kinked string, they won't be. And so this is a question. And in fact, there have been a small number of searches or proposed searches based on the kinked picture. But this is a theoretical question that we should be able to answer. Gravitational radiation is, in the short term, medium term, the most interesting, I think, way to see these. And it comes primarily from the loops because they're oscillating at higher frequencies and therefore emit more copiously. And in fact, as I mentioned before, all of the energy density from loops of a vanilla string ends up as gravitational radiation. So this is a copious source of gravitational radiation. There are still two sources to distinguish. There are the low harmonics of the loop, which basically, when you sum over all loops, produce a stochastic background, just random fluctuations of the background with a 1 over F spectrum. And that's where most of the energy goes. And so I'll talk about that first. And in fact, the strength of this can just, the amount of gravitational radiation just comes from energy conservation. We know how many long strings there are. The rate of conversion of long strings into loops is just set by scaling. And then all of the energy in loops ends up as pretty much, essentially all of it ends up as stochastic gravitational radiation. There is one, since my main theme here is the uncertainty due to the loop sizes, there is a place where this enters because the larger loops take longer to decay. And so during this period, relative redshifting enhances their contribution. The larger they are, the more stochastic gravitational radiation they make. And so when you plug in those numbers, this is a kind of a busy slide. It's kind of like a Dick Bond slide. But anyway, the current bounds, so the current best bounds on stochastic backgrounds come from pulsars. Pulsar timing is sufficiently precise that it puts a bound on how much space-time between us and the pulsar can be wiggling, and a pretty impressive bound. The total contribution of gravitational waves per logarithmic frequency interval to the energy density of the universe is less than 4 × 10⁻⁸. And if you compare that with the energy balance on the previous slide, it's a bound on the string tension. Here's this nice small number, 10⁻¹. Gamma is a number of order 1. But the size of the loops that are produced enters very directly. And if we took in my scan over possible loop sizes, if you take the largest possible loop size, namely alpha, the size of the loop relative to the horizon size is a tenth, this is 1.3 × 10⁻⁹. So you sometimes hear that the bound on string tensions is much lower than the numbers I've been throwing around. This is one of the reasons. If in fact you make the most optimistic assumption for the loop sizes, the largest possible, you get a tighter bound. By the way, the expansion has been asked about a couple times. Here's a place where the expansion enters in an important but very simple way. All of these calculations of the energy density in strings are normalized to the matter density. Because of acceleration, because there's dark energy out there, the matter density is now only a quarter of the total. And so all of the predicted energy densities are smaller by a factor of four, just because what they're normalized to is only a quarter of the total. And because of the square root here in the loop size and in g mu, this means that that because of acceleration, these pulsar bounds and any gravitational wave bound is a factor of 16 times less sensitive in g mu, which is an annoying, an unfortunate factor to lose. But even with that factor missing, even with that factor lost, this is a sensitive test. And I should mention too that, especially if early on people have gotten better about this, this factor was omitted, which then makes this number 16 times smaller, 10 to the minus 10. So when you hear that the bound is 10 to the minus 10, it's usually because the effect of acceleration has been omitted, but also because optimistic assumptions about the loop size have been made. So here you see where it's completely critical to know if alpha is 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 3, or even a much smaller number.
That's for a specific frequency range.
That's right. So this is for a frequency rate of order 10 inverse 1 over 10 years with frequency pulsar rates.
So if you have huge loops, then would they emit at that frequency?
Very good. So in fact, they do, because as you look back into the past, the loops are smaller. So no matter how big the loops are, you look far enough back and you see a loop of the right frequency. And so this has been taken into account here. Is that right? If loops are too small, then they don't contribute in that frequency range at all. But if they're large, you just look further back. And so that, yeah. And in fact, for pulsars, I think, if I remember correctly, they're over most of the interesting range looking at loops. They are. They're looking at loops that decay during the radiation era. So they're really looking quite a ways back. So that was the low harmonics. High harmonics,
if the loop were a smooth object, its Fourier transform would decay rapidly at high frequencies. But loops do this funny thing. So I told you could describe the shape of a loop by unit tangent vectors. I've changed notation here from p plus and p minus to a prime and b prime. But here's the tangent vectors on the unit sphere. They'll generically intersect, as pointed out many, many years ago by Neil Turek. And when they intersect, the string has a cusp. There we are. So it actually has a point at which the shape has a square root singularity. The velocity, that's the tip there, is moving at the speed of light. So this is like a whip. It might be galactic in size and time scale, but it's like a whip. And in fact, I used to bring a whip that I'd gotten from one of my students. And I first had a little toy whip. So, you know, whips make a sonic boom when you crack them. This is not a sonic boom, but it's making a sharp cone of gravitational waves. So one of my students gave me a really impressive whip that made a really impressive crack. But I noticed that when I used it, the audience kind of got quiet. It was too scary. And so just imagine that I'm up here cracking a whip, and every time that string cracks, it's emitting, well, not a sonic boom, but a cone of gravitational waves. And initial calculations due to De Moore and Vilenkin, very nice paper. It's a beautiful paper because it really takes you through the whole calculation very thoroughly. Suggested that they might be visible at LIGO 1 and very likely at LIGO, advanced LIGO. But unfortunately, a more careful analysis by the LIGO group identified several factors of two that went the wrong way and suggests that even for advanced LIGO, this will be difficult. So unfortunately, this, one of the things that was exciting about this was these cusps, and now they're not such an immediate likelihood. Fortunately, the estimates of the stochastic background have gone up due to the possibility of larger loops. And so while the cusp signature has become less likely, the stochastic signature, as I'll tell you, has become more likely. And so LIGO 1 would still be a stretch, but there still is the prospect for observation in the reasonably near future. Okay, so finally I come to, you know, what I've tried to do with George and Florian, which is to, you know, reduce the theoretical uncertainties. And again, after many false starts, we hit on the idea of a scaling type thing. So at the horizon scale, where things are very nonlinear, we're not going to try to compete with the simulations. We're going to let them tell us what's happening. But then to understand what's happening at shorter scales, simply consider a segment, first on a long string, and then we'll talk about loops. Consider a segment on a long string and follow it and ask, how does it evolve? And then and actually you're interested in the ensemble of such segments. And there's various, it could, you know, it evolves, it could run into another long string, it could be incorporated into a large loop and then separated from the long string network. It could be, it could emit a loop, it could emit a small loop comparable to its own size or smaller, or it could smooth via gravitational radiation. And actually, happily, things potentially simplify. First of all, one thing that's obvious is the smaller the segment is, the less likely it is to run into that segment is going to collide with another long string. And so we can parametrically ignore two. Incorporation in a larger loop can happen. But our sort of assumption that makes this approach work is that this doesn't really change the ensemble of short segments, because it depends on what the longer scale structure on the network is. And so it doesn't statistically change what we're looking at here, which is the ensemble, the statistical properties of short segments. Now, in saying this, we're making an uncontrolled approximation. So we're sort of ignoring correlations between longer scale and shorter scale structure. And one could try to improve that. But rather than try to do something very fancy and technical, we just assumed it. And it's probably a good but not really controlled assumption. Probably gets better as a string as we go to shorter distances. Emitting a small loop, let's initially assume that that doesn't happen. We don't know if it happens. In fact, we'll find this is not a self-consistent assumption, but it's good enough. And finally, gravitational radiation can be parametrically ignored because it involves a small number g mu. And so there's a wide range of scales where we can ignore it. And so one is left with a very simple picture in which the string just evolved via the Nambu equation. Now, this is actually kind of nonlinear. You can't solve it in closed form. But again, for a small segment, you can separate it into its mean value. This is these are unit tangent vectors again. Their mean value and a fluctuation, which is what you're interested in. And expanding the equations in this, you end up with this actually is just a rotation term, a precession term. You end up with something simple. As the segment moves to the right or the left along the string, the magnitude of the fluctuation just decays away in a way that depends on the longer scale structure. And the mean value of this dot product between the right moving and left moving tangent vectors is just a function of the velocity of the string. And this v squared, the mean velocity of the string, is a number that we'll take from simulation. So we're not trying to do everything. We're letting the simulations do what they can do. This is one of the things that they can do, and we'll do what we can do. So for a string in flat space, the Vero theorem would say that the mean v squared is a half. These things are moderately relativistic. Redshifting reduces this by a little bit, and a little bit more in the matter of Eureka is expanding faster. And so in the end, we can solve for the two-point function of the tangent vector at short distances. This is the thing that we were focusing on. And it decays away with an exponent, okay, in space and time, so as you move along the string, its behavior is given by a power law, and the power depends on the rate of expansion of the universe, the exponent r, and on this parameter from simulations. And if you take the numbers from simulations, this exponent is a quarter in the matter era and a tenth in the radiation era. Unfortunately, although there have been many groups that simulate these things, not many of them have published this two-point function. And when you go back and ask them, well, can you tell us what it is, they find it somehow hard to extract it from their data. One group has, although unfortunately they have a fairly short simulation time. So over very long distances, the string is a random walk. So this is the two-point function, the tangent vector. When you come inside the horizon, well, we're encouraged that it seems to follow the exponent that we predict theoretically. At shorter distances, it misses badly. But again, they have a very small expansion time. And so the network could not have equilibrated yet at these very short scales. So this is encouraging, but you know, not decisive. Very, yes?
Equation, or is it a nonlinear equation?
So it was nonlinear, but for a short string, it linear. It linearizes in terms of a fluctuation. And then it depends on the longer. This is still nonlinear, and then it couples the short distance and long distance structure. But we average over the long distance structure, and then it becomes a linear equation. That's what we got to say.
So then different modes are dependent of each other. So how could you get a scaling solution if different modes are?
Sorry, how could you get?
Different modes are independent.
Yeah, it's Gaussian. Well, actually, we're not assuming it's Gaussian, but yeah,
But so I don't understand how you can relate the amplitude of different modes because there are.
Oh, okay, good. Oh, very good. Thank you. This is a good question. Good. So for each, thank you. I skipped over this for reasons of time, but since thank you. For each mode, we know how it depends on time. We don't know how the different modes. However, again, we can. This picture only works for small segments. As we follow it back, at some point the segment is a tenth of horizon size. At some scale, it's no longer small. At that scale, we do not know. At that scale, we'll say, okay, we'll match onto the simulations. And so we have an initial condition. We assume, as they do, the simulation scale. And so that actually, so basically every length scale on the string is the same in the sense that its two-point function was normalized at the time when that scale was at the horizon. So there is one number, we called it A here, that has to come from the simulations. And everything else, thank you. Very good question.
Okay. Mark Hindmarsh and has sent us an email which looks much better in that it's a cleaner power law, and Hindmarsh and Sucker are going to put out a paper in which they've studied the network at four different expansion rates and find a power law at each rate that fits our model, not exactly, but with, I don't know whether it's a 10% correction. And again, this is good. We made some uncontrolled approximations, feeling that they were heuristically good, and it does seem like this is so far the best simulation data we have to compare with. It seems like at the level of approximation that we have the right picture, the two-point functions of power law, with an exponent that we have a reasonably good understanding of. There's a puzzle about Hindmarsh's work that I'm going to get back to later on. By the way, coming back to the lensing question, so is the string a fractal? No, it's not. So the same exponent, if you translate it into a fractal dimension, is saying that the string is getting straighter at short distance. Its fractal dimension is approaching 1, but at a rate which is pretty slow. However, when you get down to the scale relevant for lensing, it's straight enough that you expect only a very small difference, maybe 1%, say, between the sizes of images. So once you know the shape of the long strings, you can then ask, what's the probability for a long string to intersect itself? That's the question that this delta function asks. So this delta function just asks if I have two pieces of of string, what's the probability they're in the same place? And there's a Jacobian to count the number of such intersections as the string evolves. So this is something that one can insert into the two-point function we have to take its mean value. And we know how each of these things scales, how each of the components of the delta function scales, and how the rows and columns of this Jacobian scale. And that gives us a rate that depends only on the size of the loop breaking off and goes as a certain power. That's the number rate, number of strings per unit length and time, per unit. If the rate of string emission has an extra power of L. But still, now, if you integrate this, and you remember that our exponents chi are rather small, they were a tenth and a quarter, this diverges at short distances. So what it says is that you take this long string picture, and then you ask about the formation of short strings, and you find that even though the string is, well, you find that it's dominated by emission of small loops. So this is interesting. The string is getting straighter at short distances, but slowly. These exponents are small. It's getting straighter slowly. It's getting straighter slowly enough that, in fact, the kink structure at short distances gives you a divergent production of small loops. And we took quite a while figuring out how to cut this off. I mean, it meant that our approximations were breaking down. And we eventually realized that there's a very natural way to do it, which is, again, kind of renormalization group in philosophy. We earlier made a separation of the string into long and short distance pieces, but we didn't think about the time dependence of the long distance piece. So here we have a sort of typical long distance mode. These are the unit vectors on the sphere that characterize the shape of the string, superposed with a random short distance piece. And these are the tangent vectors. The string itself has a rather low fractal dimension, but the tangent vector, its first derivative, has a very large fractal dimension. So in the literature, you see pictures of this on the unit sphere often drawn, but they never were drawn correctly because I think people didn't appreciate how noisy the string is. And so what happens is so this is the right moving coordinate. This is the left moving coordinate. There's a region where the strings intersect. When the strings are far apart from each other, away from the, so this is where the long distance structure has a cusp, and the short distance structure adds a lot of wiggles on top of that cusp. Away from the cusp, there's essentially no production of small loops. And in this region, it diverges, and basically this entire region of the long string is converted to small loops. And when you look at the time as a cutoff, it turns out that, well, that the production of loops goes all the way down to the gravitational radiation scale. There's nothing else that cuts it off. So what we conclude is that the loop production is a power law going down to the shortest scale, the physical cutoff coming from gravitational radiation. Here is the best simulations, the most recent simulations due to the Tufts group. They use a trick, a doubling trick, to get longer expansion times. And this is a succession of simulations. The dark curve is their last one. They actually interpret this in a curious way. They see two peaks, a large peak at a tenth the horizon size, which is the very interesting number, and a peak at a short scale, which is getting shorter and shorter with time, but seems to be large. They believe that if they simulate for long enough, this peak will go away entirely, and the loops are large. They're at a tenth of the horizon size. In fact, if you take the calculation I just described to you, we're very happy that we get a power law, which is just the power law that they see. And another group, by the way, Ringaval, Sakalariadu, and Boucher, get similar power laws. So we, in fact, think this is not a transient. It's a real effect. It's a real effect, and it's robust, and there really is this peak at small loop sizes. It seems like the outcome is there are two peaks in the loop distribution. One of them, which we can't see the big loops. That's outside our approximation. But it certainly is plausible that every now and then you would form a big loop. We can't understand why it wouldn't fragment. Well, it's plausible that every now and then you would form a big loop that would survive. But I think the outcome, which seems to sort of now fit several group simulations, is that there are two peaks, one of which stays at a tenth the horizon size, and one of which is at the gravitational radiation scale. So in terms of my original set of guesses, the winners are, there are two winners. That's one reason it was so hard to get this figured out, the largest scale and the second smallest. Hindmarsh et al. Hindmarsh believes that maybe gravitational radiation is not as efficient as people think. And if that were true, then you actually that those small loops would really be down at the microscopic scale. That'd be a remarkable result. These, you know, this flow of structure from long distance to short is remarkable. You would say that for a string of cosmic length, the fact that it's, you know, 1,000 Planck lengths thick isn't important. But if not for the smoothing from gravitational radiation, in fact, structure would flow down to that scale. Okay, and so in terms of the gravitational radiation signatures, here's the current pulsar bound. The currently operating Parkes pulsar array is supposed to improve the bound on the energy density by a factor of 10, which is a factor of 100 in the string tension. And the square kilometer array, which is a future thing, is supposed to improve by another factor of 10 in energy, 100 in scale. So this is nice. So you're now talking about much smaller numbers than any of the other searches. LIGO will see stochastic radiation down to a string tension 10 to the minus, advanced LIGO 10 to the minus 10, and LISA 10 to the minus 11. So these instruments will cover in different frequency bands most of the range that's interesting for these brain inflation models. The high harmonics are really much harder. Advanced LIGO has a slim chance. LISA, in fact, this has the best reach on these. So in terms of seeing the strings, this is the best bet. But figuring out what you have, what is the string tension, and also the signal scale in some way with this probability, figuring out what you have if you see gravitational waves is going to require a much, much better understanding of the networks than we now have. Obviously, right now, this is kind of a cult thing, right? I mean, cosmic strings, there's a few of us who do it. We enjoy it, but you know, it won't get the kind of effort that this problem would need unless something is actually seen. This is the problem that needs to be solved: a better understanding of the networks. The gravitational wave detection is statistical; it only sees the effect of many, many strings, down to around 10 to the minus 9 over a slightly longer time scale. As I mentioned, those surveys, and even better, these small scale CMB anisotropies might actually show individual strings. And that's nice because if you see an individual string or a few of them, you can measure directly the tension. You can maybe discover that you have multiple kinds of string. And maybe you could even see a three string junction out there. So, you know, the gravitational waves are probably the quickest detection route, but in terms of actually knowing what you have, they're the crudest. I do want to mention a remaining puzzle very briefly. So there's a large set of groups that simulate the NAMBU action, the zero thickness action. There is one group that still simulates the full field theory, which has strings of solitons. And although these should give the same answer because the strings are long compared to their thickness, for some reason, the group that simulates strings as solitons persistently gets less string, three times less long string, and slower string, about v squared of about a quarter. And this is a puzzle that needs to be understood. It's easy to guess. It's easy to say, as I've tended to believe over the years, that this group is just making some mistake because they're keeping degrees of freedom they don't need, and so they're losing degrees of freedom they do need. But I will say that this group actually is the one that has produced the best results for the two-point function that agree with our model. So this is a reality check that both for them and for us, that we're doing something sensible and they're not doing something crazy. So this is a puzzle out there. But anyway, this is a long-standing theoretical problem that maybe is nearing solution. Observations will probe most of all the brain inflation range, although the inverse problem is a much longer-term thing. So if we find evidence of cosmic strings, this is just the beginning of a long era of figuring out what they are. And finally, precise understanding will require a really careful meshing of analytic and numerical methods. Neither of them can do it by itself. So thank you.
So in all this, you didn't have an extra dimension. So if you want this to actually be...
Right. So when I talked about early on about possible non-vanilla strings, one of the things that you might have is
I assume that the only likely freedom were their wiggles in the three visible space dimensions and not wiggles in the additional dimensions. Now, again, there's a reason for this, which is that when you think about extra dimensions, your first thing you think about is something simple like a periodic dimension where every point is the same. But in any kind of realistic system, there'll be much less symmetry. And in general, the string will feel a potential that restricts it to some point in this higher dimensional space. And so the wiggles away from that point will have a very high frequency. So so that's why even for strings in string theory, where they're embedded in higher dimensional space, their phenomenology is most likely to be 3 plus 1 dimensional. But, I mean, it's, again, there's a lot. It's interesting to explore. In terms of model building, it tends to focus on the more exotic possibilities. But I'm a lowly phenomenologist, so I'm just studying the simplest and most basic possible strings.
So in this gate theory simulations, so you have a set of degrees of freedom that you can emit waves, basically lose energy through emitting a scalar, right?
Well, but those should be massive, right? Because, I mean, the field theory is in the Virian-Higgs model. And so everything, right, they, and so,
but you can emit massive particles.
Right, you can emit massive particles, but to, you know, and that's what they believe is the difference. But it's puzzling. Because, I mean, if the typical wavelength on the string is cosmic, you know, it's like you would not expect to make massive particles. It's like trying to collide to low frequency. Yeah. It's the usual, you know, there's an intuition field theory of decoupling that if you have long frequencies available, low frequencies available, you don't make massive particles. Now, because of the nonlinearities of the string, it's not so simple. These cusps are like shock waves, where they concentrate energy from long distances into short. And so there is certainly the potential to make massive particles. But, you know, in the real networks, you know, unless there is some unexpected suppression of the gravitational radiation, the strings will be smooth enough through the gravitational radiation that you won't be able, the cusps will be smooth enough that you won't be able to make the massive particles at appreciable numbers. Now,
but you just argued that the most of gravitational waves comes from very small scales, doesn't it?
Well, the smallest, but when I say small, if you work out the on the long string, past a certain length scale, g nu to the 1 plus 2 chi, or chi their exponent, the smoothing is exponential, it's very fast. And so, you know, as far as I can see, in the real networks, because of the gravitational wave smoothing, you can't make massive particles at appreciable numbers. But again, what Heinmarx has done is very puzzling because, again, it's clearly been careful enough. I mean, they've been careful in many ways. And so there's something there that needs an explanation, and I don't know what it is. So maybe, in fact, there is a way to produce massive particles, which you know, I'm not thinking of, or other people.
Yeah. But one way is that it does, you produce another massive particle in your simulation because it's a dust basically. So that you have a scaling solution plus these dust particles that will dominate a string probably. And then probably they don't have that in your simulation.
They fuse because their simulations are classical. So the massive particles are still waves. I'm not sure what the is yet. I mean, I wonder if somehow. Maybe the problem is that they're classical. I don't have an answer. I mentioned it, but it's a puzzle. It's sitting out there as something that needs to be understood that could change, that could change in a serious way the bounds, even the bounds from the CMB. Because Heinmarsh argues for like that. Basically, his number gives you a three times weaker bound on the CMB string thing.
Does it have any chances to form a black hole?
Good. No, for the following reason. G mu is the magnitude of the typical metric perturbation produced by the string, which is about 10 to the minus 7th or less. So you would need to really crumple the string up to a very tiny ball to get that kind of perturbation. No. Yeah.
If there are no more questions, let's thank you again.
I don't,